Today is Monday, October 29th, 1973. My name is Gloria Thompson, and I'm interviewing Alice Corneliuson for the Northwest Minnesota Historical Center. Okay, let's see. When we were talking earlier, we decided we would start a little discussion about your family background. So if you'd like to begin with that, that's fine with me.
Fine. Now, I think that your questions here are very good. And why don't we kind of stick to the questions, and then if we want to sidetrack,
okay,
we might.
Okay, that's fine.
Your first question is, where did the Corneliusons come from? Well, both my mother and father came from Norway. My mother, with her family, came from Valdres, Norway, in 1875. And by the way, my mother was just 5 years old when she came. So she didn't remember too much about Norway.
Mm-hmm.
My father, with his family, came in 1885. So you see, that was 10 years later. My father was 16 when he came. So he really remembered a lot of things from Norway. He, for instance, remembered the three different farms where his parents and his family had lived. He remembered, of course, having been confirmed in Norway. So there was quite a difference in listening to my father and mother talk about their experiences, because he had many more experiences to remember. Why did they leave their homeland? Now, I've looked at that question. And 2 years ago, when I visited Norway and had an opportunity to visit the places where my parents came from, I really couldn't for the life of me first understand why they left that country, because it is so beautiful. I visited Gudbrandsdalen, where my father and his family came from, which is quite a distance north of Oslo, and it is, just to say it's beautiful is an understatement. I visited Valdres, where my mother came from, and I had the same feeling. And yet, of course, I know that there were at least two reasons why they came. And I'm sure that you, Gloria, know what one of those might be. Economic. You can't make a living on beauty, really. The countryside is lovely, and we're apt to be kind of enamored with that. But the farmsteads, and they were basically farmers, although back in my father's family history, there was attempts at small businesses. And so I suppose you'd say one reason was economic. And along with that, and related to it, was this tremendous promise of opportunities in America that they had heard so much about. And I really think those are the two reasons. And of course, they're related, you see. So when they came to this country, they came with optimism. And I think they had all kinds of faith in the future. They were coming to settle on farmland. The soil was virgin. And the number of acres they were privileged to start farming on was really unusual when they compared it with the little tiny plots they had in Norway. So while they had many, many hardships, because the early pioneers, if you go back beyond my parents, you know, into my grandparents, they did live in sod houses for a while. And it was building from the bottom up. And yet I think, well, I'm sure there were discouragements, but always you have a feeling as you listen to them talk about it, this optimism and this promise and this faith in the future that tomorrow will be better, next year will be better.
So you couldn't say that they were ever disappointed with what they found in the new land, per se. I mean, they were overwhelmed with the amount of land that was available to them, and
mm-hmm.
it didn't matter what they had to overcome to.
This is the feeling I have. And I don't think that my parents were any different from others.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, when I recall, have you read the book Giants in the Earth by Rolog?
No, I haven't.
Well, that also is a story of pioneer life. And my mother read it. And in there you find disappointment. Berit, who was the mother in that story, came to this country, and she was disappointed. She cried a lot, as I recall the story. And my mother's reaction to that story was, she should not have come to this country in her condition. I believe she was pregnant at the time, and it just seemed like it was overwhelming for her. Now, I'm sure that my ancestors didn't come from a more optimistic strain. It isn't that, probably. But as I remember the tales they used to tell about early days, I always look back on those experiences, listening to them, that there was this optimism, this hope, and this faith in the future. Did your family farm, you ask? Yes. My immediate family farmed. And their parents farmed. As I said, if we go back in Norway to my great-grandparents, my one great-grandfather was in business, operated a small store. And that is another story in itself, because I have quite a write-up from the Norwegian businessman's history about his experiences in the store business. But my family farmed. And they came to this area, by the way. My grandparents, my mother's family, settled near, do you know Wild Rice?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Not too far from Wild Rice. And my father and his family settled not too far from Comstock, Minnesota. Do you know where that is?
Yeah.
So you see, the two families were not too far apart. And that accounts for their later getting together and their later marriage, you see. Because people didn't wander very far those days. What was it like for them as Norwegian pioneers? I have a hard time collecting my thoughts on that one. I go back to what I said, that there was always this hope. What was it like for them? Well, number one, I think it was very hard work. We did not have modern conveniences, you see. So it was just plain, hard, physical work, which I think many people, don't know today. But sometimes I wonder if they weren't healthier for it. That was one thing. I think there's another thing. They didn't know what it was to do without. Do you understand what I mean? They didn't know what it was to do without. They didn't have conveniences. They didn't have the kinds of food we have today. They didn't have the opportunities for entertainment that we have. But I repeat, I don't suppose they missed it, because they didn't know what it would have been like to have it.
Right.
So they didn't know what it meant to do without.
One of the things I'm sort of interested in, since they didn't have those electricity or radio or leisure time, or as much leisure time, what, for example, did you do as a child, or did perhaps your parents do for relaxation, for entertainment, to... When you weren't working hard and
mm-hmm. Well, as I remember, there was a lot of entertainment centered in the home. Neighbors got together frequently And it was very usual if we stayed home on a Sunday. And we usually did. We usually accompanied. Mm-hmm. And you see, now there were no radios, no television. I guess for quite some time we didn't have a telephone. Homemade fun. Let's see if I can think of some illustration. I remember our old home, Gloria. We had a little square table in the middle of the room in what we called our parlor. And on the bottom shelf of that table was a kind of an interesting box with a viewer where you could put in pictures that showed 3D. I think they were called stereopticons. Did you ever see one?
Yeah, mm-hmm. My grandmother had those.
You hold it up to your eyes and then you put these pictures in. And there were sets of pictures of classics. I remember we had some from Rome. They were not depicting anything that was close to our experiences. Now, you ask what we did. But when we had company, someone was always looking at that. That was to entertain. We did a lot of visiting, talking. And I can't for the life of me say what we talked about. But we talked, you know, about what was happening and what we were doing and so on. And then the young people, we were great on parlor games. I don't know if I can think of any right now, but I can just close my eyes and I can just recall many experiences when the room was full of probably all ages, but mostly young people. And we'd go from one to another of these parlor games, like Spin the Platter was one. Doesn't sound very exciting. Or games where somebody would leave the room and the people in the room would think of something in the room that this person was to guess and he'd come back. And there was some kind of a code connected with it. So whenever you went to someone's home to visit, or if you entertained at a party, you just knew enough to be stocked with suggestions for parlor. We call them parlor games.
Were there a lot of books in your family?
Not a lot. But I remember through the school we had access to the Minnesota Traveling Library. Mm. And we could get, it seemed to me about our school got 50 or more books at a time and could keep them as long as we wanted to. But of course it was to our advantage to read them and return them and get more as soon as we could. And these were available not only to the children but to the families in the district. So this was our main source of book reading. Then as far as papers and magazines, we were quite modern by the time we had a weekly, or a daily newspaper. First it was a weekly, and I think it just came on Friday. And as I said, it was quite modern when we had a daily paper. Then we had a magazine, I can't remember whether it was monthly or weekly, must have been monthly, The Farmer. Have you ever heard of it?
No, I haven't.
Well, we read that. Now, there was one thing about our reading. The few things we had, we read well. The Farmer had short stories, advertisements, you name it, it had it. We had The Farmer's Almanac, we never got along without that. We relied heavily on Montgomery Ward and Sears Roebuck for mail order things. But as far as the reading was concerned, this traveling library was marvelous. We really, Gloria, did not buy many books.
What years are we talking about now?
We're talking about when I was a child.
Which would be approximately?
Which would be, well, 1910, 1915, and so on. Mm-hmm. And then in my early days when I went to a country school, those are the years. So later when we became more affluent and really began to buy books, it was quite something. There were no paperbacks either. What was it like? Oh, what was it like for them as Norwegian pioneers? I think I told you that my mother's family came in 1875. And I recall my mother telling that Grandpa used to go to Alexandria for some groceries at that time. Alexandria, I believe, is older than Fargo. Mm-hmm. So you see what I mean when I say they knew what it was. They didn't know what it meant to do without because they hadn't had these things. How successful was your family in the farming business? That is an interesting question.
Or how long did it take them?
Well, let me say, it had its ups and downs. You see, when our families first came here to farm, they had virgin soil.
Mm-hmm.
And really, crops grew in spite of what you did. It seemed like all they needed to do was to go out and drop seed in the ground, and they'd have a bountiful crop. My father used to tell that it was nothing to have a yield of 40 bushels of wheat to the acre. Barley, tremendous yields. So this was the early days. But you see, Gloria, this was soil that had never been farmed. And it was rich. And so it yielded. So, as I say, it had its ups and downs. So for quite some time, crops were good, barring hail and unfavorable weather conditions. But so far as the soil was concerned, it was very good. Well, then you know what happened. After several years, and this seemed to hit, you ask about the Depression. That was in the 30s, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Early 30s. Well, now, what caused the Depression? Well, I suppose there were many things that caused the Depression. But I do remember that my father sold oats for 5 cents a bushel. Then along with that, they had farmed the land so long, taken so much out, and put nothing back. I say they mined the soil. So they were getting poorer and poorer yields per acre. So I think that had something to do with the Depression, aside from prices and so on,
mm-hmm.
The general Depression. So when I say how did our family do in farming, it had its ups and downs, but I think you didn't need to really be educated to farm, Gloria. You just put the seed in the ground and you harvested it, and it didn't take much know-how. Now, I wouldn't dare say that today, would you?
No, not at all.
No.
No.
And farming, it was not expensive to get started in farming. You see, if you had a simple piece of equipment for plowing and something for harrowing, and they had the binders for harvesting. But when you compare that to the cost of farming today, it's just really something
mm-hmm.
to consider. How did the Depression affect your family? That's a sad tale. My father lost his farm.
He did.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose you would say it was a combination of factors. I think for one thing, this mining the soil, as I said. He talked about getting these tremendous yields when he first farmed, 40 or 50 bushels of wheat to the acre. It declined, it declined, it declined. And during a dry year or an off-season year, I think I can remember that the yield per acre in wheat went down as low as 10 bushels. And along with that, you had poor prices, you see. So, at the peak of the Depression, yes, you see, Dad had to borrow money to keep going, and he lost it. But then, your next question is, and you really thought this through, I think, what are your impressions of the New Deal? Well, of course, in our case, and in the case of many farmers, it was a salvation. Really, if I may use that word loosely. along with the New Deal and the Farm Act of whatever it was, 1933, I think it was, loans were made available to farmers so that they could buy back the land they had lost. And these loans were made out for a long period of years to pay back with low interest rates. So it was very easy to finance. I think there's another thing with the New Deal, and that is that along with it, the farmers got an education that they no longer could farm the way they used to. They had reached the point where they had to restore fertility to the soil. And as I recall, Dad started using commercial fertilizers. And this was all due to the New Deal. Because along with it, there was this education. Now, you say, didn't they fertilize before that? The only fertilizing that I can recall ever went on until this period was every year they hauled out the manure that had accumulated from the livestock. But commercial fertilizers were unheard of. And apparently this type of fertilizer didn't do the whole trick, you see. Mm-hmm. So can't you see, Gloria, that with this New Deal and this new way of farming and education for newer and better methods, farming too became more expensive because you have to buy these commercial fertilizers. You have to buy this expensive machinery. So farming today is not for everybody. And I think there used to be a feeling that anybody can farm. But not everybody can go into business. So if you can't do anything else, you can always farm. Now, I'm sure that's not true today. We see it in our own community. It's not true.
You don't have the land anymore.
Well, you don't have the land anymore, and many people don't have the know-how. Mm-hmm. And it takes capital. But I think, Gloria, it takes considerable intelligence to be a good farmer. So anyone who says to you that, he can't do anything else, so therefore he can be a farmer, I think you can just call him a liar. What did your family think of FDR's farm policies? Well, of course, I've already mentioned that in connection with the New Deal.
Right.
But you know, that affected our family tremendously. It just meant a new way of living. Now, I mentioned the farm loan. I mentioned that. But I recall when electricity came to the rural areas, and that was in the 1930s, mm-hmm. That was a part of FDR's farm policy.
That must have affected your parents' lives.
Oh, you have no idea. Mm-hmm. I can remember, and I still think I'm not an old person, but I can remember lighting, for instance, going from kerosene lamps to gas lights, and then that wonderful day when we got REA, rural electrification. But before we got rural electrification, I think we must have become, without bragging, shall I say, affluent, because we, for a period, had our own light plant. Did you ever hear that?
No, I'm not familiar with that.
It was called the Delco light plant. And the power for it was generated through a motor in the basement. So we got that before rural electrification came in. And that meant that we had our whole house wired for electric lights. And you have no idea what that meant. It was just tremendous. And not only that, but we had power for running a washing machine.
Yeah.
That power was not strong enough for running an iron, however. But we had a washing machine, which you can imagine was quite a boon.
It wasn't very common, was it, for many of the farmers to have this Delco generator?
You know, I really can't answer that. I can't remember. There were several families in our community that had it. And we had it several years before REA came through. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, when REA came through, then we could have so many more electrical appliances that it was really, I think that was the highlight. Just think, going from kerosene lights, gas lights, to electric lights. Going from turning a churn by hand to turning a churn by electric power. Going from doing all your cake baking and all your mixing with a spoon and that's hand operated to electric mixers. Well, you know, you could go on and on and on and on and on. Now, I think children growing up today just have no idea what was involved. I think of the number of times I've seen schools set up experiences for children in churning, making butter. Well, in our home, when I was growing up, that was a weekly ritual, the big barrel churn. And I don't remember how many pounds of butter we made at one time. 10, 15 pounds? Because it was a large churn, you see. But it was all manually operated. And you tell that to children today, and they look at you as kind of, you know, to say, well, she must have lived in the dark ages.
It wasn't really that long ago.
No, it really isn't. Now, do you have... Well, to sum up that one statement, that one question, what did your family think of FDR's farm policies? More comfortable living, I would say, with all of these things.
Do you recall, perhaps, do you perhaps remember how other people were feeling in this area about FDR? Was he accepted, or was he a controversial figure in the Farm Belt, or?
In the Farm Belt, I think he was accepted. There is one humorous incident that I might tell, but it does not, I think, reflect any general feeling in the rural area. But you know, Gloria, that lines of communication weren't too good. People were not as well informed as they are today. But this incident that I want to tell you about happened. And my uncle, who was very much in favor of FDR and his policies, and who had something to do with going around and getting farmers to sign up for REA, you had to sign up for it, you know. It didn't just come to you. Mm-hmm. And it did cost you something, I don't recall what it was, to get the line built into your farm. So this Uncle Ollie had said to his neighbor, isn't it wonderful what President Roosevelt has done for us farmers? And this man said, oh? Well, he said, just look, he's responsible for REA. And this man, Uncle was there to get him to sign, you know. And this man pounded the table and he said, if he's got anything to do with it, I don't want it. He didn't sign. And I don't know for how many years that family did not have REA. So you ask, did farmers generally accept President Roosevelt? My answer is yes. But I always like to cite that one illustration. But
Now, it's interesting from several standpoints. In the first place, if there had been open lines of communication, if people had access to news the way we have today, he would have known this, you see. Mm-hmm. Although newspapers were available. I just don't see how he could have helped but know it. But he refused to sign. He wasn't going to have anything to do with it. He was not a Democrat. And anything that Roosevelt did was taboo. So he cut off his own good fortune.
Do you think a lot of the Republicans in the area even accepted FDR then?
Farmers? Yes, I do.
Would you say the same held true for business types, other members of the urban area? Was it a different story for them? if you have any idea at all.
Well, of course, I never thought of it that way, Gloria, so much. But I do know that at that time, business was quite dependent on the rural area for its livelihood. It was a vicious circle, you know. So that whatever was to the advantage of the farmer would be to their advantage. So for that reason, I think they accepted it. It just seems to me that I heard very little by the way of opposition to these new farm policies, because life had become so difficult. It was just about impossible to get the necessities of life. And this was a promise for something better. Whether it happened to be Democrat or Republican. And of course, in this case, it was Democrat. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe things would have changed under another president, a Republican president. Maybe we were so ready for a change. I don't know that. Maybe President Roosevelt happened to come in at an opportune time. Franklin Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
This, of course, we'll never know.
Right.
But when you have seen things go from what was a promise of a good day gradually downhill, when it had gone about as low as it could get, and then you saw a future again, you couldn't help but go along with it. Now, what is the picture today? This is not one of your questions. I talked to a woman who owns a farm in the community where my family farm is, who had a yield of 80 bushels of wheat per acre on a field of wheat this year. How about that?
Wow.
Now that was just a small field. And this was a good year for farming.
Yeah, they got $5.
Yes, but this is not talking about the price, Gloria. I'm talking about the yield.
Mm-hmm.
Now this is quite different from the period that I was telling you when the soil had been mined. The soil couldn't give a yield. Now, if we go back to this farm that I just mentioned, I said to her, but I am sure you and your tenant put quite a bit of money into that piece of land in the way of fertilizer. Oh, she said, I don't know how much money we spent on fertilizer. But you see, this year now, that was well spent. Good yield, good prices. Now, some people are looking askance at farmers today and thinking they're getting too good a deal through the good prices. I think they've got it coming.
I think they do, too.
Now, unless you have any other questions here.
Not in long.
I did write in the margin here, what did your family think of FDR's farm policies? And I didn't use the word because I realize you're taping it. It was a godsend. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Education. Did you attend a country school? Yes. In Bay County. District number 99. And there were at that time, when I was going to country school, there were around 150 one-room rural schools in Clay County. And today there aren't any, I guess. Where? What was it like? Well, I told you, it was near our home, near Comstock and Ruston. And I wouldn't know where to begin to tell you what it was like. You've never gone to a country school. Can you imagine going to a one-room country school where the teacher has all 8 grades? And the number varied, but I remember 25, 30. You'd have some in first grade, some in second, some in third. And the daily schedule was set up so that at most any class period would be like 7 minutes. And the teacher would spend her day going from one class to the other. 8 reading classes, 8 arithmetic classes. Because at that time, they really didn't combine grades. If you were in the first grade, you had first grade classes, see? But one of the things that I remember with great delight is how much I learned by listening to the other children. And I remember when I was in first grade, the 7th or 8th grade, I don't remember which one, was studying Evangeline in literature. And I could no more do my so-called seat work. Do you know what that is?
No, I don't.
That's work that you do at your desk by yourself. They call it seat work. I suppose because you sat while you did it. But you see, after each class, we would be assigned something to do when we went back to our desk. Well, when this 7th or 8th grade had their class in Evangeline, I couldn't do what I was supposed to be doing at my seat because I listened. And when they were through with that story of Evangeline, I knew it from beginning to end, and I just loved it. And I suppose I was 6 or 7. Of course, consequently, many times I was reprimanded for not having done what I was supposed to have been doing. But I think this was one of the big advantages. You learn from others. But you see, you were not supposed to be listening. You were supposed to be taking care of your own work. There was nothing like a hot lunch. We had carried our lunches in not fancy lunch buckets, syrup pails or something like that. And there usually was a stove of some sort in the middle of the room. The teacher did all her own janitor work, took care of the fires, planned her work, swept the floor after school. Quite different. And then at the end of the year, when you were in the 8th grade, you took what was called state board examinations in each of these subjects. And that determined whether or not you passed that grade and could go into high school, if you planned to go to high school. But that was not compulsory. Another interesting thing was that there was a state law which said that you had to attend school a minimum number of days each year. At one time, that was 40, Gloria. And at that time, the length of the school term was 6 months, not 9. But out of that period, if you were under 16, you had to attend a minimum of 40. Well, I had 2 brothers who were near my age. They were older. But you see, my dad needed help on the farm. And my father did what most of the other people did. He would keep my brothers out to help with farm work, but always careful that they attended the minimum number of days. How about that? And any family where there was a laxness and where it looked like the children were not going to be attending that minimum number, the superintendent would get after the family.
Oh.
So you see, there were laws, but when did you start teaching? 1927. And my first teaching position was in Oak Mound School, 10 miles north of Moorhead.
Now, how did you become certified for that? Did you go to
Oh, excuse me, I skipped this.
I think I forgot to mention it.
Yes. Yes. Well, now, how did I get my... My high school work was kind of an interesting experience. You see, we had no high schools in the country. And at that time, what is now MSC was Moorhead Normal School. And Moorhead Normal School at that time offered a 3-year course and a 5-year course. And the 3-year course was part high school. So I attended MS for 2 years, I guess it was, and took high school work. Then, because I wanted to be a graduate of a high school rather than a normal school, I took my senior year in Moorhead High in 1924 and 25. So I was a graduate of Moorhead High. And in order to get accredited, I had to have my work transferred from the Moorhead Normal and evaluated. And in the meantime, I had taken some correspondence work, too, from the Moorhead Normal, because I had had to stay home a couple of years to help my mother.
Mm-hmm.
This is digressing. But I came from a family of 9 children, and I was the middle one. So we had to take turns staying home. And that's why, when I was a senior in high school, I was a little older than the average. But I graduated from Moorhead High, and I was so thrilled to really be a high school graduate. Then, in the fall of 1925, I went to what was then Moorhead State Teachers College. It had changed, I think, yes. And I took what was called a 2-year course in preparing to teach elementary schools. And I majored in upper grade. Then in the fall of 1927, I had an opportunity to teach at Oak Mound School north of Moorhead, which was then a 3-teacher consolidated school. And it still stands there. If you go out, you can see it. Great big structure, 3 stories. And at that time, that was one of 4 schools affiliated with Moorhead State Teachers College for students preparing to teach in rural schools. So we had student teachers. And we had a teacher agent connection. Part of the building was turned over into a teacher agent. We had 4 student teachers at a time. There were 3 regular teachers, a matron, and a janitor.
Oh,
and we all lived in the building. It was quite some gay time. Well, then I taught there for 4 years, and during summers, and during the year, too, I took work at MS toward my 4-year degree. So I took my degree on the installment plan, which was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Then I just had a little bit left to get my bachelor's degree when the man who had been supervisor of rural student teaching from the college, you see, they had to have a supervisor, was invited to join the State Department of Education, so there was a vacancy, and I was asked to come on the faculty and take that job. And I remember, I think I took work at MS at the same time that I was doing that job that year, and then finished my 4-year degree in the spring. Then I was asked to take this job with the understanding that I would get my master's as fast as I could. So, my thought, of course, was to go to the University of Minnesota because I just couldn't see that I could afford to go anyplace else. So the head of our department, the head of the education department, called me in one day and he said, "Alice, where do you plan to get your master's?" "Why," I said, "the University of Minnesota, of course." "Well, now," he said, "you know, you've gotten all your education right in your backyard, practically. You live south of town. You attended a country school. You took the rest of your work at Morehead High and at MS. Don't you think you should get farther away?" Well, I said, "I haven't the money." "Oh," he said, "I think you can borrow money." And I have always been so glad he did this, that he gave me this advice. So I thought, well, if I'm going away, I'll go as far as I can without falling in the ocean. And I went to Columbia University, New York City, and got my master's. I did it in 3 summers. And I have never been sorry. It was tremendous. For someone who had lived a rather, what's the word I want, provincial life? Would you call it provincialism? Whatever it is.
Possibly.
I think rather confined. This was a tremendous experience.
I can imagine that it would have been. Mm-hmm. I was surprised that your family encouraged you as a woman to pursue high school and higher education.
That's an interesting question, and I think you have one here. Gloria, I cannot tell you whether my family encouraged me. They certainly didn't discourage me. But I wanted it. And it wasn't easy, you see, because as I said, we were a large family. We had to take turns staying home. My 2 older sisters had attended Morehead Normal. And they had taught. I think they had helped to establish a pattern. And I think in those days, Gloria, it was more common for the girls in the family to feel that they should get out and make a livelihood rather than the boys, because the boys seemed to be needed for farm work. Yes, my father and mother encouraged me, but I think it was, I was highly motivated on my own. I wanted this. And it was a toss-up between becoming a nurse or becoming a teacher. And I don't really know. There wasn't this much involved in choosing a career then as there is today. There was nothing like applying for admission. You just appeared at the registrar's desk. And I think I hadn't made my decision until about the day or two before MS opened in the fall, that it was going to be teaching and not nursing.
What were some of your experiences at Columbia? You were saying how fantastic it was to...
Oh, the Broadway plays. We saw every play that was going, you know, during the summer. And the summer season, of course, is not the peak. But, Gloria, to be in a city the size of New York, just to be in that large city was an experience for me. I remember my first subway ride. Tremendous. All I had known was streetcar rides and some train trips and so on. And at Teachers College, Columbia University, I think the general atmosphere in teaching, well, I don't not only think, I know, it was very liberal. Teachers College, Columbia University was known as an experimental school. And I recall observing in their so-called laboratory school, for me, who had come from rather Oh, a strict school environment. I thought it was most interesting to see the attention that was given to the learner. And there was a word used then which I think has fallen into disuse, progressive ideas, which was misinterpreted, I think. And are you an education major?
No, I'm not. History.
Have you ever heard of Kilpatrick, Dewey, Bagley? If you were in education, you would have. I had those three for instructors. And they have been names, big names in education. That was a thrill. Just sitting in a large class and having Dr. Kilpatrick as a teacher was worth the price of my master's degree.
Was it difficult for a woman in higher education at the time? Were there many women in your class?
Yes, quite a few women. Most of the women majored in elementary. There were very few men majoring in elementary education at that time. Mm-hmm. You ask about the place for women in higher education.
In Columbia, for example?
Yes. Well, Columbia and other places. I think women were kind of breaking ground, but I still come back to a statement I made a while ago, that in the rural area, it seemed like girls thought they had to get out from under the family roof and prepare themselves to make a living, while the farm needed the boys to work. Now, women in higher education, I came to MS on the faculty in 1931. And because I worked with county superintendents, rural student teachers, and so forth, I always attended meetings at the Minnesota State Department of Education. Mm-hmm. For instance, the State Association meetings for county superintendents, because I was in rural education. And there were almost, most of them were women county superintendents. I remember the first state convention for county superintendents I attended. I am sure the ratio must have been, I'm hazarding a guess here, 5 or 6 women to 1 man. Elementary principals and superintendents. Have you any idea why?
Not really.
Well, actually, I suppose we'd say that it didn't have the professional regulation or professional reputation that other aspects of higher education had. Now, for instance, elementary principals. Usually, an elementary school principal was also a teacher of a grade. So you were elementary principal in addition to teaching 6th grade. It was not as highly professionalized as it is today. I suppose partly because schools were smaller, there were many more elementary schools, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But as things changed, as the job became more professionalized, as salaries improved, and as requirements increased, more and more men were attracted to it. So today, actually, here in Morehead, there are few women elementary principals. They're men. Is that good or bad? I don't think it's either one. It's just something that has happened.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are probably several reasons for it. One thing is, a man knows, at least he has in the past, that he has to provide the wherewithal for living. He's looked to as the head of the family. He was then. And there wasn't enough in this thing we call elementary principalship to attract men. Now today there is. So more men go for it.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one time talking to one of the state college presidents, this is several years ago, about the fact that there seemed to be a decreasing number of women on the faculties in state colleges. I think this was the president of Bemidji State College I was talking to. And I said, why is that? He said, I'll tell you why it is. More and more we are being pushed when we hire new faculty to get faculty with PhDs. And there just are not enough women with PhDs for candidates. He says somehow women stop short of their PhDs. Now, I'm not sure. I've been retired 3 years whether that's still true or not. I think there probably are more women now with PhDs. But he said that was a problem. Now, why didn't more women go on for PhDs? I don't know. Unless they thought... Have you an idea?
I don't know, unless it would have been reasons of family and marriage and children, those
right.
kinds of things.
Right.
You know, then that...
That teaching was a stopgap.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was.
You know, and a lot of, I think, the people that hired the women felt that, that this would be true as well,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, sooner mm-hmm. or later the women would get married and have children and quit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, I know that when I prepared to teach, I'm sure I thought 2 years was all I was going to have. Well, then I got catapulted into this other, you know. If you come to MS, if you join the faculty, if you get your master's, so forth and so on. I'm sure that was not my original intention.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't intend to teach that long.
Yeah, I can understand that,
mm-hmm.
sure.
And I'm sure that's rather common. What were the attitudes of a woman from the Midwest?
The attitude, I guess I meant of the, would,
of the
Easterners toward a woman from the Midwest in grad school. I don't know if that's a fair question.
I think it's a fair question. I'm not sure that I have an answer for it. I remember that the 3 summers I was working on my master's at Columbia, who was president of MS at that time? Oh, Dr. McLean.
Oh.
And there were 6 of us in my category. We didn't have our master's. And we all decided to go to Columbia. 1 summer we went by bus, and 2 summers we went by car. One of the 6 then, I think, took a train. And we were together in 2 classes that 1 summer. And the professor was a young woman, very energetic, who herself was from St. Cloud originally. And she used to speak of the Minnesota gang. And she'd say once in a while, well, now, what does the Minnesota gang think of this, you know? And, of course, here we had people from all over the nation. We had people from other countries.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you asked this question, what were the attitudes there toward a woman from the Midwest? We kind of felt like we were special. Now, was it because there were 6 of us and we sort of made a name for ourselves? I don't know, one way or another. We felt accepted, respected. I think probably at that time there was a feeling that the East, so far as schools were concerned, had a corner on progressive education. And that the farther west you went, the more conservative they became. So by the time you came to the Midwest, we probably, so far as progressive education was concerned, were conservative. But we certainly felt accepted. I just loved it.
Did Columbia change your attitudes about education, educational methods? Did you bring, you felt you brought new ideas back?
I thought I did. I felt it helped me a great deal.
Did you have a hard time convincing perhaps colleagues from this area that they were legitimate, not too progressive or not too...
Well, I don't think I went out on the left limb, but I know that, you see, much of my work at MS was in supervision, working with student teachers in classroom. And, oh, I felt that it helped me a great deal in trying new ideas. I remember one time, at that time, Gloria, it was not so difficult to try something new as it may be today. I remember shortly after I got my master's, I had an idea that I wanted to try for a summer workshop. You see, rural schools did not run in the summertime. And it involved having a rural school in operation, a rural school 9 miles from Marquette. And it involved my having a class of students, mind you, called the Modern Rural School. And I went to Mr. McLean, who was the president, and I said, you know, I have an idea. You see, our faculty was small. So you didn't feel like you were imposing on the president. Now, just imagine, I went right straight through to the president. Because he was much interested in rural education. And I said, I have an idea I'd like to try. Well, he said, tell me about it. And he said, well, what would it cost us? I said, I don't know. You'd have to pay for the teacher in this rural school. I was going to be on the staff anyway. And I said, it would involve having a college class that was not listed in the catalog. Well, he said, I don't think that's a problem. And before I left the office, I practically had the go-ahead sign. Mm-hmm. He said, have you a teacher in mind? I said, yes, I have. Do you think you can get children to attend in the summertime? And I said, yes, I think so. And it was a great experience. But it was not difficult to get permission to try new ideas.
That's good. We're nearing the end of our tape. Do you have anything else you'd like to add? We have a couple of minutes left.
No, I'd just like to say this, that I think this has been tremendously interesting. One thing I might add, if we have a couple of minutes, I was a little embarrassed when you called and asked for this interview because I feel that I really don't know too much about Red River Valley history. But I have an interest in history. And some years ago, I did write a family history, Descendants of Johann Andreas Hagemath Corneliusson. Well, Gloria, I've always been interested in family history. And back in 1958, I had a sort of a family history published that I had worked on for, I think, 5 or 6 years, I don't recall. And one chapter in that history dealt with reminiscing, because I thought just to have a genealogical listing of birthdays and marriages and deaths would be kind of boring and monotonous. So one day I asked my father to tell me about a newcomer's first years in a new country. And so essentially these are some of the things my father told me. He said, when I came to this country, I was 16 years old, and I came with other members of my family. This now was in 1885. He recalled that his brothers Martinus and John advanced money for the 7 members of the family who came to this country when he did. Now get this, it cost $150 for the 7 to come to the United States. And he reminisced about the experiences of a newcomer. And then to quote my father, he said, "I got a job working for David C. Askegard on what later became the Peter Dahlstrom farm northeast of Hickson, North Dakota, along the Red River. My pay here was $15 a month. On the morning of my first day at the farm, Mrs. Askegard asked me to go with her down to the river to check the fish lines to see if any fish had been caught. And sure enough, there was one, a big one. Mrs. Askegard asked me to grab the fish behind the gills while she held him close to the shore. I was covered with mud, but it was worth it because the fish weighed 31 pounds. It was a catfish. I learned a lot about farming while I was with David Askegard. Early that first summer, I was put to raking hay with a hand-operated dump rake. I had made a couple of rounds in the field when my brother John noticed that I was dumping hay hit and miss rather than in windrows. It was a new thing for me, and I didn't know how it was supposed to be done." You see, never operated machinery. "In threshing, I was given the job of holding sacks while Lars Tonsager measured the grain with a half bushel measure into the sacks as it came from the machine." Now this, Gloria, was a threshing machine, not a combine. "Lars was evidently a good man at the job. One day he had to be gone a little while, and someone else took his place. We were threshing oats at the time. It wasn't long before the situation got out of control. When Lars returned, he handled the measure fast and furiously so that the grain just flew. The machine had a trip counter mounted on the box, and this was tripped once for each measure. We finished threshing that first year on the day before Christmas. The men with the threshing crew had to find their own places to sleep. Now listen to this. Lars and I tried sleeping in the wheat bin on the wheat, but the grain was too cold for us and we had to move. We dug ourselves into the straw pile, and after we had settled down, I said to Lars, 'Suppose this straw pile burns, then where will we be?' Lars said, 'Don't mention it.' We threshed with the steam engine, using straw for fuel to furnish the power. Among the many people who got their thrashing done on this run were Ryans, Andersons, McKinseys, and so forth."
Did he mention anything about the difficulty with the language barrier?
He never did. He, of course, when he came, Gloria, and the place where he came to, they spoke mostly Norwegian, you see.
That's what
I was. So there wasn't a language barrier.
Did you speak the language as a child?
Yes. We spoke Norwegian in our home, and I was confirmed in Norwegian.
Mm-hmm.
So you see, there were nine children. I was the middle. And our church services were always in the Norwegian language. Well, then, but when my brother next to me came along to be confirmed, you see, we had gradually turned to the English language.
Do you recall when that would have been?
Well, I was confirmed in 1917, I think. Yeah, 1917. And we were using a lot of English then. But you see, the shift to English from Norwegian was so gradual, I couldn't put my finger on it. But I was going to say, my brother next to me started to read for the minister, as we said. And of course, it was to be Norwegian. Actually, I think there was a feeling that God was Norwegian. And unless you were confirmed in Norwegian, you had no chance in this world or the next world. So my brother started in Norwegian, and he didn't know what he was reading. He was just saying words. So one time he came home after he had met with the minister, crying. And he was repeating, one of the commandments. And then he said, in Norwegian, Mama, jeg kan ikke. Mama, I can't. So mother and dad had a conference. What should they do? Should they let him take it in English? Because by then the minister had some in Norwegian and some in English. I don't know how he did it. Well, they decided it was better for him to be confirmed in English and understand it than to be confirmed in Norwegian and not understand it, come what the results might be. So he broke the barrier. But Gloria, when I started teaching at MS and when I did rural student teaching, supervising in these schools, I remember one little rural school we had not too far from Moorhead. We had a pair of twins, started in the first grade. Now this, my dear, was in 1931, who could not speak English. Mm-hmm. Now what would be your attitude today if you taught and you had a child who could not speak English?
Well, if it were Norwegian, I would be quite astounded.
Well, in those days, actually, this was just 1931. Doesn't seem long ago, Gloria, to me. I think it was kind of, we thought it was kind of a shame, you know. Now, if this happened today, I think you'd take those children and you'd make them feel that they knew something that maybe not everybody knew, and you'd build them up.
Mm-hmm.
The philosophy is take the child where he is. Don't degrade him. But that teacher was really remarkable. I remember in language, Olaf and Gunder. Those were their names. Isn't that something? Olaf and Gunder. She would say, each day now, we're going to have Olaf and Gunder teach us the Norwegian words for some of the things that we're saying in English, and then we'll teach them the English. And I thought later how smart she was. Whereas I think in the days when we were making the transition from Norwegian to English, like I said, it was very gradual, but there was a tendency to be ashamed of speaking Norwegian. Now I think today, how too bad. But as I said, this teacher who had Olaf and Gunder really knew her business. She made those two boys feel that they really had something that not everybody had. They could speak Norwegian. And when they came to school, they kind of hung their heads. And when called on, they blushed as if they were ashamed of themselves. But they hadn't been in school long before they really squared their shoulders, held their heads up as though they were somebody. But you see, there was that period when it was a shame. You should be ashamed to speak Norwegian. You're supposed to speak English.
Rest, 1983. This is Roland Dill interviewing Alice Corneliuson, an alumnus and former faculty member at Morehead State University. This is the Morehead State University Oral History Project. Alice, we're glad to have you here.
Thank you.
Let's begin way back with the Corneliusons.
How far back?
Well, when did the Corneliusons come to the Valley, and where did they settle, and where did they come from?
Now, that's a triple question.
Right.
My mother came from Norway. Are you familiar with Valdres, Norway?
Oh, yes.
In 1880. And she came with her parents and another sister. And they settled near Wild Rice, North Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
Homesteaded. My father came in 1885 from Toten, Norway. And he came with his parents and a Now, I wasn't prepared to answer all of these questions, but I think there were six brothers and sisters. Mm-hmm. My father was 16. And they settled on the Minnesota side of the river, all between what would now be Comstock and Rusted, uh-huh. on a farm, homesteaded.
So that was a Norwegian community on both sides.
Yes, it was.
Of the river.
Mm-hmm.
That's the farm that your father settled on.
Yes.
His parents. Is that still in the family?
No, it isn't.
That's not the Cornelius.
It
farm.
Has been. No, it isn't. It has been. It has not been in the family for quite some time. My grandfather sold it and retired. Oh, I don't know what years. A long time ago, and moved to Comstock, mm-hmm. and he and Grandma lived there.
But you yourself grew up, though, in the community south of Moorhead.
Yes.
Closer to Comstock or to Rusted?
Closer to Rusted. Now, you asked about the Corneliusen farm.
Right.
I think you're thinking of my father's farm, then,
right.
our family farm. My father bought that piece of land before he was married, and then they built their house and lived there. So that farm was started by my father.
Mm-hmm. Well, where'd you go to school?
That is, to me, interesting. I went to school in a little one-room schoolhouse 1 mile south of our home for the 8 grades, mm-hmm. 1 through 8. And, Mr. Dill, that was interesting.
It's relevant, too, because we're going to come back to country schools before we get done here, you know.
Are we?
Oh, yes.
But I went there through the 8th grade. By the way, I had my two older sisters as teachers at different times.
Oh, did
it
you?
It was a one-teacher school, you know, and they were both graduates of Moorhead. Mm-hmm. As I said, it was 1 mile. We walked most of the time, but then later... we had an old horse who was trained so that he could be hitched to a buggy. Mm-hmm. He took us to school. We turned him around, and he went back home. And then at 3:30, the folks started him back to school to pick us up. Now, that was quite an interesting kind of bus service.
It certainly was, yeah.
Wasn't it?
Right.
And I suppose at that time there must have been four or five of us going to school.
Mm-hmm. How about high school?
I think you said you weren't prepared with questions, but I begin to see you are.
We're going to get you to Moorhead State eventually,
uh-huh.
but I want to find out how
you're
you got
there
here.
Right now.
All right.
Where did I go to high school? I didn't go to high school out of 8th grade. First of all, when I finished the 8th grade, I was 16. You see, we didn't start school as early.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you're real smart, you'll soon know how, you know, when I was born. I can tell you
that. We'll figure that out.
Okay. I was 16 when I finished the 8th grade. Then, in the fall of that year, I started Moorhead State Normal School.
Mm-hmm.
And I have proof of that here. I'll show you if
All
you're
right.
interested. I have my first registration forms, State Normal School, Moorhead, Minnesota, with my grades on them. And I think the name of the registrar... Now, when I started in September 1919, I started as I guess we were called freshmen. We were, you see, undergraduates. But at that time, the normal school, many of the students were undergraduates.
Right, yes.
And I registered for what was called the advanced curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
The first 3 years were high school.
I see.
And then the second 2 years were teacher education preparation.
Mm-hmm.
So I went that whole first, that year. I stayed at Wheeler Hall, 16 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And then I attended intermittently until the fall of 1924.
I see.
Then I decided I wanted to be a high school graduate. But you see, when I started, high schools were very uncommon. There were very few of them.
What were there south of Moorhead? Were there any high schools in Rested, Comstock?
No, there were no high schools. No, it was Moorhead. But you see, my two older sisters had attended the normal school through high school and college. And so that was the easiest thing for me to do. But then I decided I wanted to be a high school graduate. Mm-hmm. So I had my credits from the normal school and then the State Teachers College transferred to the Moorhead High. And so I graduated from Moorhead High in the spring of 1925.
Now, did you have in 1925 some of that two-year college work, or had your work up to then
from
sort
the
of in that three-year high school?
That was all high school.
I see.
Yeah, my credits from the normal school transferred as high school.
Well, with two older sisters who were already teachers, there's no problem about your going to college. It was something that was not that unusual in your family.
There are two things I kind of think of in connection with that. Why did I choose to come here? Mm-hmm. You know, I suppose it was because it was a natural thing to do. My sister said,
"Well, now you went to a Lutheran church and you spoke Norwegian in the home. And
there
was a Norwegian Lutheran college in Moorhead. Any thought about going to Concordia after you got your high school degree?
Never. Would you like to know why?
Yes.
Couldn't afford it.
You could, well, that's a little surprising.
That's one reason.
Of course, by 1925, you probably couldn't. That World War I prosperity had disappeared.
It never occurred to me, I guess. Mm-hmm. The only other thing I was interested in preparing for was nursing.
I see.
But somehow, it just seemed the natural thing to do. But, Mr. Dill, it was so easy to register. I just presented myself at the registrar's window and told her who I was, and... Oh, you are Milanelli's sister, which was good, and it was also bad, because, you know, there were just 40 faculty members, and they had most of them had Milanelli, so they kind of expected you to be the same quality, but it was fine.
Was there a sharp division between the faculties of the high school, and you came here then, you're 16 years old, and you lived in the girls' dormitory, which was for both high school and college students. Just students. Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
Because I remember I had a roommate who was quite a bit older than I was.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like all ages.
How about very young? Let's say that after the eighth grade, I suppose some students might have been as young as 12. They didn't come here, though, I suppose.
No, they couldn't have finished the eighth grade by 12, because children weren't allowed to start the country schools that early.
Thought they might have skipped a grade here or there.
That was not the thing to do.
Not the thing to do then.
You know, I don't think.
Well, as you think about your first experience here, now obviously you knew something about both Moorhead Normal School and Moorhead.
Mm-hmm.
A dozen miles was a little farther those days, but you must have come to town a good deal. Were you fearful of the experience as you cut loose from home, as it were?
No. I can't remember, Dr. Dill, that I was ever fearful. I think I was lonely sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But to go home for weekends was usually by train.
Usually by train.
Uh-huh. To Rested. And then came back by train. So you see, I didn't go home every weekend.
Uh-huh. All right, here you are in a dormitory filled with girls and women.
That's right.
Where were they from? What kind of a range of students came here geographically?
Well, I have my preceptors here. The area around. I remember Argyle, Warren, Minnesota, Crookston.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, in the immediate vicinity, Fargo. There were several from Fargo.
Staying in the dormitory?
No, not in the dormitory.
Not in the dormitory.
No.
Local students didn't, I suppose.
No, of course not. But people who did not stay in the dormitory, lived in homes, came by streetcar to the campus.
Oh, yeah.
Streetcar.
Right.
The streetcar came way up on the campus to as far as the dormitories.
Oh, yes. Were there mostly women or Was it split between men and women in Moorhead Normal School?
Mostly women, although, as you look at the preceptors, this is the one for 1919-1920, mm-hmm. we had some men. I think the enrollment in 1919, I counted last night, there were 100 seniors, 1920. And I would say, I didn't count the number of men and women, but maybe a fifth were men. That's just guessing.
Mm-hmm. And everybody was, well, was everybody after a teacher's certificate?
Yes. It was only a teacher education.
There was a single curriculum then mm-hmm. for that. All right, you graduated from high school, mm-hmm. then at Moorhead High School. What'd you do then?
We see the following fall.
You started Moorhead, by that time, Moorhead State Teachers College.
Yes, I started here in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
And then I attended Moorhead State Teachers College for 2 years,
mm-hmm.
preparing to teach.
Where'd you live then?
Well, then I did not live in the dormitory mm-hmm. again, but I'm real glad I had that 1 year. Then I lived, part of the time, one or the other of my sisters attended, so we had, I guess you would call it a semi-apartment,
uh-huh.
or rooms with cooking privileges, let's call it that.
uh-huh. When you decided to go to Moorhead Normal School for the high school,
mm-hmm.
were there other students who went to Moorhead High School at that time, directly out of the eighth grade, from your area?
You know, Dr. Dill, I cannot remember. There were not too many who went on.
Not many that went on. How about, and fewer
about,
men,
we're
and
talking
fewer
about
men,
nine,
I take it.
1919,
yes.
aren't we? There were not too many who went on.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not surprising, I guess.
Well, for
with
one
high
thing,
school that far away.
That's right. The high school that far away. You know, there was no busing service.
Mm-hmm.
And it was costly. And then another thing, the men, the boys, were needed at home on the
right,
farms.
Right.
And many of the girls went out to do domestic work. You see, we were a large family. We were nine children.
Mm-hmm.
And we couldn't all stay home.
Right. All right, you came here then as a first parts of several years. Were many of the same faculty members, of course, are still there.
Oh, yes.
The ones you'd known first.
Uh-huh.
Let's talk about a couple of things that haven't got so much to do with the college itself. Your life in the town of Moorhead. Here you were, a long way from home, at a time when all students were no doubt well-behaved, men and women, but you weren't locked on the campus. You got out into the town. What kinds of entertainment did you find? Did you go to church in town, for instance?
Yes. I went to what was then Trinity,
mm-hmm.
one of the many churches. You know, they've had several
yes.
buildings. We'd take the streetcar to Fargo, which was a great treat. Or on a Sunday afternoon, we'd take the streetcar to Dilworth. We transferred somewhere a long way. That was a Sunday afternoon outing.
Uh-huh.
Wonderful. Or we'd walk downtown. Going to a movie was a great treat.
Mm-hmm.
Many of the things that we think today are really nothing, we thought were great.
Mm-hmm.
We had school parties.
All right, how about school? You had school parties?
Yes. The first year I was here, we had school parties in the gym of the Old Main. You've heard about Old
mm-hmm.
Main. And, we played games, and there was some dancing. And we played cards in the dormitory. But you see, the social life in the dormitory was a little limited because lights went out early.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had to do any studying, you either did it before the lights went out or you did it by candlelight. I often did that.
Mm-hmm.
We all did. We weren't allowed to, but we did.
Oh, yes. All right, let's... how about sports? I haven't asked you about that. There were the college had teams of various kinds.
Yes. I played... Oh, I should have brought my gym outfit. I like to play basketball.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you know, within the girls who were here.
Yes.
And the boys, well, yes, they had sports, the few of them.
Now, in high school, they were playing in a regular schedule. Women were. They played other schools. But that, how about in college? Was there a women's team that played Concordia, for instance, in
no.
basketball?
Not that women. Had, that was just local.
Disappeared. Mm-hmm. But the men,
see, this
of course,
was quite early.
Yes, but it was kind of late as far as women's sports are concerned, because
uh-huh.
it disappeared in a few years. In the early 30s, they almost completely disappeared.
But I remember one of the things we enjoyed, when I was here in 1919-1920, I had Flora Frick for
mm-hmm.
a gym teacher. You've
right.
heard of her.
Oh, yes.
Well, when I came back in 1925, Jessie McKellar was here.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember she introduced archery in the spring.
Oh, yes.
And that was very popular.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of tame, but it was
yes,
fun.
Right. All right, you've mentioned a couple of teachers. How about teachers? Who else do you recall? Naturally, emphasis upon eccentric types, if any.
Oh, Catherine Leonard, who was a math teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Perfectionist. Excellent.
Mm-hmm.
Burl Martin. I'm sure you haven't heard of him. He wasn't here too long. English teacher. I liked him very much. Maybe because he liked me. I knew it. He was a good teacher, though.
Mm-hmm. Good teacher, anyway.
Uh-huh. Good teacher, anyway. And let's see, who else?
But you weren't that much younger than he was, either.
No, he was very young. Mr. Berge taught geography.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Ballard,
you
science.
Knew Ballard. You had Ballard.
Oh, I had him as an instructor. Uh-huh. And Maud Hayes.
Maud Hayes and what, speech and English?
Yes. I think I can tell you an interesting story about Maud Hayes.
Good.
Have you heard anything about her?
No,
well, anyway,
our tape has.
She taught. She taught English and literature. She came from the East. She had had. She had been in Oxford at Oxford, and she had a broad act teacher. Well, I had registered for world literature from her. So we came to the class the first day with our notebooks and our pencils sharpened, and Miss Hayes walked in, squared her shoulders. Out came the notebooks. The minute she opened her mouth to speak, we started writing. She stopped, and she said, "I'm going to tell you something right now. I don't want you ever to open your notebooks again in this class. I don't want you ever to take a note. If you can't remember on Judgment Day what you should remember in order to pass, then that's just too bad. So you come here and you relax." Now, how do you think we felt? Tell me.
Lost.
Lost. Because, you see, we were used to writing everything that the instructor said. The first few days, I just was so uncomfortable. I thought, oh, will I remember this? Will I remember this? But you see, she didn't give the kind of an exam where you had to list five of this, four of this, or it was essay. Her exams were really quite terrific. You had to think.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope if she read them all, she really had a lot to read. Of course, classes weren't that large. She was an excellent teacher. Thought-provoking. Maud Hayes.
Mm-hmm. So you had a sub-curriculum, pretty much.
Oh, and I had Dan Preston.
All right, Dan Preston.
Taught music elements. And, of course, he was young, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Right out of service, practically. Delightful. I wouldn't mind saying this maybe this will have to be cut. Dan, when he first came here, but I didn't have him when he first came, my sisters did. He was quite shy. I think that's a compliment. Mm-hmm. I told him one time, I said, I think you've lost your shyness. And he said, was I ever shy? Delightful.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk about the curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
Let's pass the high school part up and come to the college curriculum.
Just as well, because it was very fixed.
Very fixed. What you were all preparing to be teachers.
Mm-hmm.
Were all the courses directed towards that?
No. I know what you're getting at. You want to know if we had any general education.
I guess I am getting
at that. I think you are. I'll help you on that. Yes, we had... I had American history, I had world history, I had sociology, math. I liked math. I took math. I think maybe some as an elective. What else would be general education? Science, mm-hmm. some. But we had, of course, other than general education, methods courses.
Right.
But I think we had, for just 2 years, Dr. Dill, a substantial enough background in general education for that amount of time. And, of course, we had to know, I think, how to teach.
Mm-hmm.
Probably one of the most outstanding parts of my 2 years preparing to teach were the 3 months I had student teaching at Glendon. We lived in a teacherage.
Oh, yes.
And we had a wonderful supervisor. That was real experience.
Mm-hmm. The model school,
mm-hmm.
that was in existence, of course, by that time. Who student taught there? Or wasn't it used for student teaching?
The model school, as you know, was a part of Old Main.
Mm-hmm.
It was added to Old Main. You see, Old Main was like Topsy. They started with part, and then they grew.
Uh-huh.
They added. Well, the model school was added in 1908 as a center for student teaching. And then they had certain number of children. First elementary did some student teaching there. That bell, do I dare ring it?
Why don't we ring it, yes.
Was used first in the, I think it was used in the model school. They didn't have automatic electric bells
mm-hmm.
to signal the children to come in back to the classroom. The bell was passed on. I think it belonged to Blanche Loudon.
Mm.
Have you heard of her?
Oh, yes.
Who was?
Her sister lives across the street from me, remember?
Did she? Oh. Here's her picture. She was principal of the intermediate grades.
Oh, yes.
And she had this bell. Then when the model school, you know, burned with Old Main.
Right.
Then the campus school was built in that building program.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. She had this bell then. As she was also principal then. So I have an idea that this bell is quite old.
It probably is. Probably very old. As
it's now going to go to the archives.
Good.
She passed it on to Marie Sorkness when she left. And when the electric system was installed, I don't know, because, of course, then this just became a conversation piece.
Let's go back to 1919, when
you
started high school.
Mm-hmm.
How long did that high school department last in the normal school?
You know, I really don't know.
But it was gone for some years before it was reestablished in the campus school, wasn't it?
Say that again.
The high school came back to the campus with the campus school. Now, you said they added the junior high and the model school.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually they added the high
senior
school.
Senior high school.
But there were some years, I think, when there was no high school program
right.
on the
That's
campus.
Right.
That high school program was there, as I understand it, in the first place, not to provide a model setting, but simply because there were a lot of students who couldn't go to high school or couldn't go to college until they'd gone to high school and didn't have high schools in their own
communities. I think that was partly the reason.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But I don't know how long a time it was when there was no... I don't know when the senior high school was added.
No,
see, I wasn't too involved.
Yeah, that's right. All right, let's go back to Glendon.
Mm-hmm.
How many schools like Glendon took our student teachers in those days?
That was the only one.
That was the only one.
Mm-hmm. And they accommodated 10 students at a time. Only girls, because they could only accommodate girls in the teacherage.
I see. Was there any student teaching in the Moorhead School?
Yes, there was. In fact, I think my sister Mella did some teaching in one of the Moorhead schools under the supervision of Miss Emma Erickson. I heard her speak of her. I don't know too much about it. There was some.
Mm-hmm.
Not much.
Now, by the time you had come back after graduating from high school, was there a four-year program for high school teachers by that time?
Was there a four-year program for high school teachers?
That must have been added sometime after,
I think,
about that
I
time,
doubt,
I guess.
I just don't know when that was added.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a degree.
Right.
The first degree was granted to Art Storms, a single graduate. I don't know the year.
Uh-huh.
But that was after... I don't know when. Whether it was late 1920s or early 1930s.
All right.
But Art Storms was the first degree graduate.
Where was he from?
I think he was from out near Monaga or Frazee.
Mm-hmm. All right. We've got to see you sort of graduation.
I really didn't anticipate. Go ahead.
Want to find out. Anything else about life on the campus from 25 to 27 that you'd like to talk about? We're going to get you out of school and then back to it as quickly as we can.
27, anything else?
You've talked about teachers, you've talked about the curriculum, talked about downtown, talked about Fargo.
Uh-huh. Time went so fast.
All right, we graduated then.
Let's go way back.
All right.
You know, this is probably going to get us off the track completely. But when you're talking about preparing for the centennial celebration,
mm-hmm.
you're thinking about the 100-year history of the college, the university, or what have you. I certainly think that one tremendously important contribution from the college was in rural education.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So
you would expect me to say that.
Yes, we're going to get to that very soon.
Am I pushing?
No, let's push right into that now.
But you said something about, did I remember anything else? Not personally, but from this history, you know, of rural school affiliation,
mm-hmm.
that extended from 1917 to 1951. Did you know that?
I knew it was that long. I didn't know it started that early.
That is 34 years.
Mm-hmm.
And my sister Nellie told about when she attended Moorhead Normal.
Mm-hmm.
She took a class in rural education, and the instructor, Anna Swenson, took the group out to Sunnyside, which was the only rural school they had, by bobsleigh
mm-hmm.
to observe. But they didn't do student teaching out there. But they went out by bobsleigh to observe. I think that is interesting.
Oh, yes, yes.
Because I didn't have that experience.
Now, the Affiliated Rural School Program, who originated that? It got national attention, as I understand.
You know, you kind of hit so many points of stimulation that I don't know where to answer. It got national attention. May I answer to that first?
Yes.
Yes, it did get national attention. When I was invited to join the faculty back in 1931, it was with the understanding that I would get my master's. I had barely finished my degree on the installment plan. Mm-hmm. So Dr. Archer, who was then head of the Department of Education, said, "Where would you go for your master's?" Well, I said, "I hadn't thought about it until today in your office. But I suppose I'll go to the University of Minnesota." "Why?" Well, I said, "Because it's closest." Well, he said, "There's a danger that you will be too provincialistic." I think I hardly knew what the word meant. I looked it up. And then I said, "Well, what would you suggest?" "Go as far as you can without falling in the ocean." That's all he said. Mm-hmm. So I contacted Margaret Beery, who was supervisor or director of rural education. Well, she was a graduate of Teachers College, Columbia, mm-hmm. and just for Columbia. She said, "Alice, why don't you go to Columbia?" And I thought, why not? Mm-hmm. So in the summer of 31, I really had hardly finished my four-year degree. I think there were four of us from MS, four or five, who went to Columbia for the first time. And I presented myself for registration to the head of the rural department, rural mm-hmm. education. And this Dr. Fanny Dunn, who was a supervisor, said, "You're from Moorhead." I said, "Yes." "Do you know anyone there?" "Margaret Beery." And she said, "Why did you come here?" I said, "Well, I've been invited to join the faculty as a supervisor of rural schools affiliated with the college. And I understand that this is the best place in the country." She said, "That's interesting. We here think that Moorhead State Teachers College has one of the best, if not the best, rural education department in the country." I was quite interested in that.
Yes.
So you see, when I came to Moorhead as a rural school supervisor of the affiliated schools, I really came into something that had already been founded and was going full speed. Mm-hmm. I thought that was interesting.
Oh, yes, yes. All right, let's cover very quickly the time from your graduation until you came back in 31. 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Those 4 years were spent at Oakmont Affiliated School. Have you heard of that?
That's north. That was north.
10 miles north of Moorhead.
Yes.
It was a three-teacher consolidated school in Clay County.
Mm-hmm.
And I was asked by the college to take a position there when I graduated from the two-year course, which I felt quite honored to be invited,
I think so, yes.
Because we had student teachers, you know, four at a time, and we were supervised by college personnel.
Mm-hmm.
It was a real experience, marvelous experience. Besides that, we had fun.
A teacherage?
We lived in a teacherage.
Oh, yes.
Four student teachers, three teachers, a matron, housekeeper, and a janitor. We played whist, we played bridge, we went to parties, we were entertained. We worked hard, mm-hmm. but it was great. Wonderful supervision from the college.
Uh-huh. How many schools were affiliated?
At its peak, I looked that up last night, at its peak, 13. One, two, and three teacher schools.
Mm-hmm. All within fairly close distance to Moorhead?
All within, I think the farthest was 15 miles.
Mm-hmm.
15. But you see, yes, I guess we had 13 at one time. I suppose rural school affiliation reached its peak. It started in 1917. with observation. I imagine it reached its peak in 1936, 38.
Mm-hmm.
About there.
Now, I assume that the purpose of affiliation was not simply to provide good places for students to student teach. It must have had been a great advantage to the local school district to have that kind of association. Were you as a teacher, for instance, there?
I find it very difficult to answer your questions very briefly. You know,
there's no
I just can't
here.
Do that because now that question is quite interesting, I think. There must have been another reason besides providing student teaching centers. Yes, there was. President McLean, or Dr. R.B. McLean was president when mm-hmm. I joined the faculty. He had a background in rural education with the State Department. He was a man of few words, but he was a very deep thinker. I remember the day I came to the campus to assume my duties. It was the beginning of the winter quarter in 1931. I was asked to come here as supervisor of rural affiliated schools, taking the place of Ole R. Sandy, who had been in that position and who had been invited to join the Minnesota State Department of Rural Education. So I was filling that vacancy. Well, President McLean asked me to come to his office at 9 in the morning. And I thought, oh my. You know, that was quite a moment. I was young.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't think that I had enough experience under my belt to do this, really. So he welcomed me and asked me how I felt. And I said, frankly, scared. I really am. He said, why? Well, I said, I am really afraid to try to fill Mr. Sandy's shoes. He stopped and he looked at me and he said, no one has asked you to fill his shoes. You come here and fill your own shoes. Which was, I thought, a very, very encouraging comment to make and made me feel better. Then he gave me, I think, a 10-minute talk on his philosophy of the affiliated schools. And that's an answer to your question. And he made it quite clear to me that it was not that we were to use these schools for our good as a college, but that we must give, and that in the final analysis, he was interested in the best education. Today, they'd call it quality education mm-hmm. for the boys and girls. So he said, I want you to work with the student teachers, yes. Work with the regular teachers, yes. Work with the school boards and see that they comply with the highest standards. I have never forgotten that, coming from the president mm-hmm. of the institution. I thought it was a wonderful orientation. Don't you?
Oh, yes, indeed.
And so I used to think, I spent a lot of time meeting with school boards. And when I did that, I found myself having to listen to their talk about farming lots of times by the hour before we could accomplish the job for the meeting that day and that night. But it was part of the game. It was, I think, to build. You may have to help me here. I think it was to build a working relationship. We couldn't just go in there and push our way.
Right.
But you had to be interested. If I was on my way to visit at Riverside, we'll say, which was a one-room school, and the farmer living near there happened to be out getting his mail, it was very important, I think, that I stop and visit with him. Mm-hmm. I remember one time I had reserved a whole morning to visit at Riverside. I spent 1 hour with this farmer. Maybe it was poor judgment. I don't think it was. And I think Mr. McLean hit the nail on the head when he said, you work with the whole community. I think it helped me. And I've often thought, you know, that would be an important thing for administrators to remember.
Oh, yeah.
Isn't it?
Yes, yeah.
But you see, the college was small. The faculty was not large. And I suppose maybe it was easier to reach around. And yet, I just have utmost love and admiration for President McLean. There were times in the winter time. I remember one time particularly. Now we're getting. I'm getting off the track. He was terribly concerned that I not go out in snowstorms. Mm-hmm. You see, I drove out around the country. He appeared at my office door at 8:30 with his arms across his chest, and he said, "Alice, you're not going out today, are you?" And I said, "I hadn't thought about it yet. Maybe not, I don't know." Well, he said, "I don't want you to." Concern for the individual, which was another way of showing his philosophy showed through,
right.
I think, concern for all individuals. He loved to visit the rural schools. As sure as anything, if he had a visiting dignitary, we'd get a call. So-and-so is going to be here. I'd like to have them go out to see the rural schools.
Well, I can see why they cooperated.
I think probably he helped those who worked with him to see the goal.
Mm-hmm.
I know he helped me.
Right. Well, let's talk about the campus in 1931. You went to the president's office. Where was that?
McLean Hall.
McLean had been finished by that time.
No, wait a minute.
December 31st.
McLean wasn't built until finished until May 1932. His office was. We were so huddled together on the campus, you know. Where was Mr. McLean's office? I don't remember whether it was in Weld Hall, in Wheeler Hall. No, McLean Hall, I'm sure, wasn't finished until May 1932. You see, the fire was February 9th, 1930. Then the legislature had to appropriate money. So his office. Some offices were in Weld, some were in the dormitories. It probably was in Wheeler Hall.
Uh-huh. Where were you at the time of the fire?
Haven't you ever heard that story?
No, I've never heard that story.
Oh, Lord. February 9th, 1930, the night of the fire, the college burned down. I was teaching at Oakmount.
Mm-hmm.
We had four student teachers. There were three of us teachers, a matron, and a janitor. We had a telephone connected with Moorhead, one of these wall things that rang, you know. Our telephone rang, I don't remember what time. You see, the girls, their student teachers, had rooms in the dormitories, and they had vacated them for the 6 weeks they were doing student teaching. So one of the girls answered, and this person was crying, and she said, "The college is burning." Hung up. So I called the fire department, and they said, I was advised, yes, Old Main was on fire, just roaring. Well, what were we to do? You see, we didn't have a car. Teachers didn't buy cars the first year they taught.
Right.
But our janitor had a car, and he had always told me anytime I wanted to use it, I could use it. So I thought, well, should we pile into the car and go down and see it? So we decided that that was not the thing to do because they already had more people than they could accommodate. So we stood in the attic of this big three-story school building with windows, and we could look to the north, and as each floor fell, you see, those were wooden floors. They had been oiled and varnished, and they were ready for a fire. As each floor fell, the flames just shot up in the sky, and we could see that from Oak Mountain. So we all cried. The college was on fire. The girls wondered if their belongings in the dormitories were in danger, you see. So I said, well, they don't advise us to come in, I asked. But tomorrow we'll go in. You know, take turns. We can all go at one time, which we did. It was a very sad time. And that's how we watched it that night. And I knew my records were there. Well, you think of so many things. And, of course, the people, in an effort to salvage what they thought was important, we heard all kinds of weird things about somebody who grabbed a fernery from the library, was it, and carried it out in February and set it on the ground. So it was frozen to a crisp the next morning. Mm-hmm. And I guess... I don't think they were able to get all the records out. I know they weren't because most of mine burned. That was a traumatic experience.
For the whole town, I would guess.
Yes, it was. But, you know, then, of course, we heard all kinds of weird tales afterward. The college was not going to be rebuilt. Mm-hmm. It was not going to be built. But, as you know,
it was.
But after the fire was over, the ashes were cooled off, President McLean called his faculty together. I don't know how long school was out of session. Not very long. Then you see, this was 1930, wasn't it?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. That was February. So it was around... And I came in 1931. I had a little tiny, tiny corner someplace in Weld Hall for an office. We learned what it was to be sandwiched in. But it worked.
Yeah.
If you have to.
Mm-hmm. So when you came, they had started to build then what was later to become McLean Hall.
Yes.
The new old
when
building.
I came in 1931, I suppose the building was in session. I know it was May 1932 when it was finished.
Mm-hmm.
And the moving into those new buildings was tremendous. Tremendously exciting.
Tell us about it.
Well, just the idea. Here we had classes in little cubicles in the dining room of the dormitory, in the parlor of the dormitory. And all of a sudden, here we had these lovely classrooms, new furniture. You almost felt that you had to dress up special. Really? Of course, I don't know if you dare say what was the biggest loss. The library, you know, was a tremendous loss.
Right. All right, now, from 1919, 1931, 12 years, you'd been associated one way or another with the college. What were the differences in the early 30s from the post-World War I period? New building going up, a couple new buildings going up. Lumen Hall, but it's not called Lumen Hall.
Mm-mm,
it was going to be built fairly soon, wasn't it?
The campus school, or whatever you call it. You call it Lumen Hall now. It was a part of the same building program as McLean.
Okay, there's a four-year program, not just a two-year program. What other changes? Those are kind of obvious.
Well, changes are so... Dr. Dale, changes are always so gradual.
I know, that's what
we're trying to fix them. You know, it's so difficult. I don't know just when all this came about, but when did Dr. Snar come here? I don't know.
1942.
Well, you know that. Well, of course, there are always changes with a new administration, you know. And the humanities added, which was a new philosophy.
Right.
And it takes time to sell a new philosophy. I happened to be secretary for a number of years of the Humanities Council. Delcy Holmquist was chairman. And that was an education in itself, because you kind of grew with it. But I used to say so many times when the humanities as such was introduced into the curriculum, you're talking about integration, aren't you, really, here? Where you take a period of time, like the Renaissance, the Renaissance, whatever it is, and you bring in the music and the history and the literature and whatever, and relate it. And at that time, I said, you know, this is interesting, because this is what we've been trying to do in the elementary school for many years. We tried it when I first started to teach because we had too many subjects, Dr. Dill, when I was teaching, like 3-4 different grades. I even taught some high school. It was perfectly ridiculous to teach geography with might and main for 10 minutes, and you lop off and you teach something like history for 10 minutes or 15 minutes. And something else that somebody had already thought of doing this at the, and we had done it in the elementary school, and that was the emergence of social studies, which somebody liked to think of as a combination, correlation, or what you will, of geography and history. That when you're studying this part of the United States, we'll say the western part, why not study the explorers, the pathfinders, the history? The one makes much more sense. So we had done that, and there was some raising of eyebrows, and I said, "Well, that's the truth. We have, but we did it for two reasons. We." Studied it at the university, but we were quite interested that it seemed so silly. You could have longer periods, you could have reading, you could have language all on that one topic. You could have a whole hour, an hour and a half, and that's what you're trying to do. But I maintain that the elementary school took the lead in humanities. So having an opportunity to be on the Humanities Council was a wonderful experience for me.
Now, that came with Dr. Snar in 42.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did.
University of Chicago.
Yes.
Let's go back further, then.
Okay.
We've got 10 years in there before Dr. Snar came. You found yourself now as a colleague of people who'd been your teachers.
That's right.
A different view? Learn anything you didn't know before?
That's an interesting question. I didn't think you'd ask that. That is a very interesting question. I often thought of it. Because here I had Dr. Byron Murray as an instructor. And suddenly, we were colleagues on the same committees. I had had Dr. Archer as a professor in many courses. And here now we were. I had had... No, Miss Leonard was gone. Margaret Beery. There were many. Jesse McKellar, who became my... But it, one of the things, it took me a long time. I haven't completely gotten over it. Dr. Kesey, I had him several times. And here we were. I was on several committees with him. I never reached the point where I could call them by their first names. Today, I do speak of Byron Murray as Byron. I don't know when that happened. It just happened, you know, normally. Dr. Kesey, I guess I haven't. I think I'm kind of changeable there. Sometimes maybe Joe. I think if I see him, I used to see him in the grocery store and I'd call him Joe.
Mm-hmm. How about people you knew who were students when you were? Any other of them who had come back in the 30s as members of the faculty? Some came later, I know.
Who were students who came back as on the faculty? Yes, Ruth Hansen.
Mm-hmm.
May Tangen. Amanda Orsted, but not here. She's on the faculty at Winona. Alice Nesvold. Oh, yes. She went to Bemidji. Quite a number of our graduates went to faculty positions in other state teachers' colleges. I was trying to think of here. Florence Powell, Grace Mastu. There were quite a few.
Now, you've lived in and around Moorhead all your life, so mm-hmm. coming to the faculty and the faculty of the institution you'd graduated from, you didn't have the problem that you might have had if you'd come from 500 miles away to a new job in a new town. How was adaptation for people who came from some distance? Now, I suppose that from the time you first came as a student until you came back as a faculty, there was some difference in the origins of the people who were hired. It seems to me a lot of people from the East on the first faculty.
Yes.
For 20, 30 years.
You can see why, I imagine. In the early years,
mm-hmm.
Dr. Weld's influence.
I see. And then more people from Minnesota thereafter.
More look.
Do you think it's getting inbred?
From Minnesota?
Yeah. That's not to be a bad thing. I've never been sure what it is.
It can be a bad thing. I have never thought of it. I think I have heard it spoken of as something that we should watch out, you know, for. You asked about problems in adapting if people came from far away.
Well, I think of somebody who's on first or second job, a long way from home, suddenly dropped down in Moorhead.
Uh-huh. I remember someone who turned out to be a very good friend of mine, Eileen Sheppy. She came here to the campus school faculty at a time when I was living in the dormitory. You know, there was a period of time when the dormitories were not filled with students.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. So some of us, younger faculty members, just imagine, were asked if we would be interested in living in the first floor rooms of Comstock and Wheeler. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, apartments were so scarce, Dr. Dill.
Right.
That it was quite, we enjoyed that. I lived in Wheeler for a while, lovely room on first floor, and I lived in Comstock. Well, then, of course, as the enrollment increased, we had to get out. But now coming back to your question, people coming from a distance, adapting. Eileen Sheppy came from Iowa, rolling countryside, and her parents brought her here from Ottawa. And she had been promised a room in the dormitory to begin with. And she was terribly blue. Oh, she said, we came in on Highway 52 through Barnesville, and I thought, is this what I'm coming to? But she said, she told us later, she didn't tell us right away, she was just heartsick. She thought it looked lonesome. But she said she thought that one of the things that helped her was getting in. She lived in the dormitory for a while, you know. She kind of mixed quickly. She got over that. But I think it first hit her. And I can see that.
You had the experience of never having lived in a dormitory as a college student, but living in a dormitory both as a high school student and faculty member.
Yes, that's unusual.
Did any changes? Now, of course, you're 16 years old. I assume a great number of college students seemed terribly glamorous to you. And when you came back as a faculty member, they weren't as glamorous anymore. We had moved through the roaring 20s, which I take it didn't roar as much on the Moorhead campus in some places.
No, they didn't.
As a matter of fact, one might almost say the opposite, that by the 30s there was somewhat more
freedom. I sometimes think we were too good.
Well, who's to say?
I don't.
But certainly by the 30s there had been all sorts of influences on people. Everybody's more used to automobiles and to moving around. Mm-hmm. Radio in every home. You said that you worried about being provincial if you went to the University of Minnesota.
Yes. I didn't worry about it until I was told I should worry about it.
Well, that's good enough. Was the student body provincial, would you say, in the 30s? Sackle Astrid has commented on the kind of students that were you found at Moorhead in the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
Can you generalize about them? You worked, of course, most closely with very, very serious students embarking on their
careers. My first reaction to your question would be, I think we were all here for a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
As if I were to contrast that with, you know, when I came later as a faculty member and on through the years, when I served as an advisor to students, in those early days, we came to prepare to do something. But I think later on, a lot of students came, and I had them tell me this, because they were expected to go to college, and they didn't know where else to go. Or one girl told me, one time she came in to see me about her program, and I remember she was having trouble, and we talked about it, and I said, are you happy here? And she said, no. And she cried, and I asked her why. Well, she said, I don't want to teach, you know. I said, well then, what would you like to do? I'd like to be a hairdresser. So I think I did the unforgivable thing of saying to her, well, you know, God bless you. If there weren't hairdressers, I don't think I'd dare come to school, really. Mm-hmm. And so I said, asked her, why are you here? Because my mother wants me to be a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Now, she was here under pressure to prepare to do something. Well, she, of course, didn't stay. She didn't make it. But then somewhere along the way, they started to come without a goal in mind. We'll come here for 2 years. I think that, tell me if you disagree, I think that came along with general education. I don't blame general education. But there was a general feeling, and I think this was publicized pretty much, you may not know what you want to do when you finish high school, But you can go and take the first 2 years, and that's general education in most universities and colleges. Am I right?
Oh, yeah.
Well, then there was this change, you see. We had a lot of people coming in who didn't have a purpose.
Well, I suppose one of the reasons we told them to come was so they'd find a purpose.
Yes, and I think that's all right.
Mm-hmm.
If we are supportive and can help them if they need help in finding their purpose. Not telling them, but
and if they don't
at least them. Listening.
Right. How about the early 30s, early middle 30s? We're told that students often went to college because there weren't any jobs. We hear that, of course, in the early
depression,
80s, too.
Depression.
Right.
Yes. That's true. That was depression. And they came. We had a lot of them here at MS.
Mm-hmm.
One reason, it was less expensive than private colleges.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something to do.
Mm-hmm.
Something worthwhile to do.
There was some student aid, of course, with the
yes.
National Youth Administration.
I don't remember just when that started. Do you?
Oh, I suppose 33, 34, maybe. Maybe earlier, but not much. Not before 33.
Oh, I doubt it. Federal, you mean?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Because NYA program extended to high schools, too.
But students could go to school then, of course. On much less money. I think all of us did with less.
Mm-hmm. Well, you had to. Now, I saw recently a copy of a letter from President McLean to the faculty. I think it came out in 1934 and accompanied a contract. So you'll notice your contract is for 80% of the salary
mm-hmm.
you are being offered this year.
Mm-hmm.
He says, as nearly as we can tell, this is the intention of the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody had a 20% salary cut that year. He said, except for people who were in the lower range. I take it the lower range, $1,200.
Yeah, I remember. They were tough years, Dr. Dale.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, I was from a farm. We went through the depression. Wasn't easy, but it was also a challenge, I think. And I don't think, as far as teachers in a college were concerned, that we ever thought of revolting.
Mm-hmm.
God forbid, striking.
Mm-hmm.
That'll be cut. That was something you had to go along with.
Yeah.
Do you understand what I mean?
Oh, yes.
It was a challenge. We had to... The times were bad.
Well, I'm one of the people who thinks back to the Depression. I sentimentalize it a little bit, and I say, well, we helped each other out. There's more neighborliness. Now, that may very well be because of the age I was. It seemed the neighbors were terribly important. Is that true, or is it just a sentimentalization?
No, I don't think it is a sentimentalization. I heard Pastor David Anderson say about a month ago in a class I was attending at Trinity, so along the same topic. He said, we have lost our hospitality. Today, I think we were discussing one of the Psalms. Today, if somebody drops in to visit you, you know, if they stay an hour or more, you know, we just don't stay. We don't visit like we used to. We're just not that hospitable.
Mm-hmm.
But back in the years gone by, we were.
Probably not so much a part of the result of the recession. That's some other things.
Probably what?
Not so much a part of a result of the depression as of the way we were brought up and the distance we had.
We change.
Mm-hmm.
We change.
Were you aware of students who were really extraordinarily needy at the time?
Yes. Yes, I was. I knew of students who, girls who had, you know, a little pocketbook.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And boy, they'd count their change, and one girl would say, well, I have less than $2 to live on until so-and-so. Mm-hmm. Yes. You knew that they were needy because they couldn't afford to buy clothes. Mm-hmm. And if they lived in a room and had cooking privileges, they brought food from home and they got along on next to nothing. Mm-hmm. Yes, I knew that.
Now, a couple of things you said suggests that there was a wider range of students in the 30s and later. And I suspect that that's not only because some people had purposes and some people didn't, but there must have been very different kinds of students. Was it easy to categorize students? Did you say, here you have this kind of student, the serious student, here you have the person after success at whatever cost, here you have the athlete, here you have the playboy. I'm trying to get some sense of what interactions were like among students.
Well, I think, you see, back, I don't know how far back we go, it was mostly a girls' school, mm-hmm. don't you see?
Yes.
I don't know what proportion. But then, as with the degree granting, mm-hmm. and maybe with, I don't know whether salaries were better or not, there were more opportunities for men. Mm-hmm. But early, you know, it was not the thing for men to do.
Right.
But when more men, well, more boys came to the campus, that brought a change. Certainly, in the chemistry of the campus, if nothing else. No, really. You can just imagine that.
You think about men on the campus. One of the people gets talked about a good deal, of course, is Nemzik.
Slim Nemzik.
Slim Nemzik.
Yes, I had him as an instructor.
Uh huh.
He was a coach.
Yes.
But the coaches then also taught one or two classes. Mm-hmm. He taught American history.
He of course put a lot of time in on his coaching. He's
yes.
Famous for as a coach. He also had a lot of other things he was involved in, the National Guard, for instance.
Yes.
And various community mm-hmm. affairs.
Very active in the church, mm-hmm. in his church, in the, I don't know whether it was Kiwanis, Rotary, or whatever it was, he was active in service clubs. Mm-hmm. Chamber grounds. Slim was a very active man, civically.
Mm-hmm. It was in the late 30s, I suppose, that he began, or sometime past the mid-30s, that he began recruiting students out of Michigan.
Yes. Ilamino was one who married a Sarkness. Uh-huh. Then if you get one or two, you know, you get more. I don't know what started it.
I was understood. I don't know what started either, but I always understood that he promised them a room in the armory if they joined the National Guard.
Well,
it was as good as a scholarship.
And I don't call that bribing.
No, of course not.
Dan Preston said, and you've heard him say this, I don't want to change the subject, but it's the same thing, that he used to go out and judge high school music, and he was always looking for likely students to come to the campus. Dan Preston and his wife Ruth, with their family, Little, they made it possible for many, particularly men, he would recruit people with likely music ability. And they'd say, I have no money. And Dan would say, well, I think we can fix a bedroom in the basement, and if you'll help around a little bit, you can have your meals. So this was quite common. And I don't call that what's the word I want? I call it recruiting, yes.
Oh, yes, and I guess nobody can...
But it was good recruiting.
Nobody can criticize anybody for joining the National
we
Guard.
We had, yes, National Guard, yes. You remember we had a student who was awarded the Distinguished Service Award the other year. And he quoted, he talked about Dan Preston doing this, you know. He said, if it hadn't been for him, I would never have gone to college. And many said that about Slim.
Now, one of the things I've thought about from time to time is that Sliv was, I guess, a colonel in the National Guard.
Yes, he was.
He got a lot of students to join the National Guard.
Mm-hmm.
But in 1936 and 37, there's really a very strong anti-war feeling in this country as a result of various kinds of congressional, especially the case investigation of the armament industry. Mm-hmm. And Europe looked as though it might be hatching another war. And a lot of activity directed against our involvement in war. Keep our boys out of war was
right.
A fairly constant slogan. Was that strong on the campus?
No, not particularly. Mm-hmm. I think I know of that sentiment.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think we can be surprised that it was there.
No, I guess not.
We have somewhat the same thing now.
Yes.
Haven't we? That's history.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take another look at the faculty. I asked you about people you were colleagues of. Who was new and exciting when you came back, and who new and exciting
in 31?
In 31, and in the decade that followed, who were some
on
of the
faculty?
People you really
on the faculty?
On the faculty. When I say that, it's a totally subjective judgment. Who do you find particularly interesting, or people you wanted to know better?
When I came back.
Mm-hmm.
When I first came back.
You mentioned Ballard. You haven't mentioned Bridges, another...
Oh, Bridges, bless him. Yes. Sam Bridges. He was a great man. Mm-hmm. A great thinker. Philosopher. I had him as an instructor and then as a colleague. And when I came back and he was on the faculty, I just revered him, really. He was like our preacher. He didn't preach at us, but I kind of looked to him as, you know. I remember when he died. I don't know whether he actually retired or if he resigned because of illness.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose it's in here and I've forgotten it. But when he was at home and he was ill, the faculty wanted to do something for him. And I think we decided to give him a copy of a new version of the Bible that had just come out. And somehow I was delegated to go to his house and present it. And he was really quite ill, but it was the most wonderful experience. You know, he took this Bible and he took a couple of Bibles he had. And as sick as he was, he really was most interesting in analyzing the differences. Because I remember I took that new Bible, I think it was the American Standard Revision. And I said, Mr. Bridges, and I never called him Sam.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I'm not so sure. I like the King James Version. I said, I don't always understand it. But I said, you know, I think they've taken too many liberties in this Bible. They made it so, brought it down to everyday language.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, Alice, if more people will read the Bible and understand it, then it's the right thing. And he said, you just said you don't always understand everything in the King James.
Mm-hmm.
No, but I said I kind of like it because it's was the original. No, he was great. Now, here he was, you see, he was quite an old man.
Mm-hmm.
He could have condemned this modern slant.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't. Marvelous.
Well, he hasn't seen some of the indignities visited upon the Bible since then.
Yes.
The Reader's Digest version.
Yes. Isn't it the truth?
You said he was sort of like our preacher.
I thought
of
him,
you
know, kind of our chaplain.
You know, you did have a chapel.
Oh, mercy, yes.
How often was chapel held?
When I was a student, it was... Was it every day? I wonder. And then it was once a week.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Mr. McLean, Brother McLean. He often read out of Isaiah.
Mm-hmm.
I'll bet he read that whole book out of the Bible in chapel.
Yeah.
He always read a Bible verse or two.
Oh, yes.
Now, I like chapel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they took roll.
They did.
Mm-hmm. His secretary and some people from the office went up and down. We were assigned seats.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine?
Just about.
But, now this is part of my heritage. Didn't hurt us.
Mm-hmm. What else went on in chapel besides the Bible verses?
We'd have speakers. We sang songs. We sang.
What did you sing? Not just hymns, I take it. Or sing any hymns?
Yes. We had these red books that were in the back of the pew seats, you know. We sang, I suppose you call them hymns. And Alma Mater.
Mm-hmm.
Dan Preston directed us.
He's still doing that.
Uh-huh. But we knew the Alma Mater. I don't remember if we sang it every time. And then we'd have speakers. Sometimes we'd have special music from the students. You know, this is off the subject, but it's on.
Oh, we don't
it's
have
on
any,
the subject.
We don't have any tracks to follow.
You know, one of the great moments for me was the installation of the electric organ.
Hmm.
I wonder where that is now.
I don't know.
Well, anyway, Weld Hall Auditorium had nothing but piano music, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then the Alumni Association had a campaign to raise money for an electric organ for the auditorium. And we really went to town on that. I think that thing cost only, it was under $3,000. But that, Dr. Dill, was a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the thing had been installed, and all the speakers and everything, and we were going to have a test play. So President McLean and I from the Alumni Association and two or three others, he came over. I have never seen anybody so thrilled.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, Alice, isn't it beautiful? Little thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
It was big. It was big. Then we had a concert, of course, to dedicate it. But I remember, because I was treasurer of the Alumni Association, it was under $3,000. I think it was $2,400. In $1 contributions, $2 contributions, $3 contributions. And somebody had the generosity to give
$50.
Uh-huh. Little things. Isn't it?
Oh, yes. Listen, now we've gone through the 30s, sort of, in our way.
Have we?
I mean, I need some really exciting and funny anecdotes, of course. If not, we get to the next big part in the life of Morehead State, and that's the Second World War, which made some changes.
Oh.
How about your own assignment? Now, how long did you stay as supervisor of the affiliated rural schools?
I can't give the number of years. I'm not prepared for that. I was 4 years at Oak Mound. Then I came here in 31. First, I was supervisor of the affiliated schools. And then Ms. Beery was director. And when she left, I was made director. I just kind of grew into that, slid into it. I suppose counting Oak Mound, counting supervising the rural schools, counting being director of rural education, I must have spent like 24, 25 years of
right
my professional career.
Mm-hmm.
Then I was principal of the campus elementary school. I just checked that the other day, and I couldn't believe it. 13 years.
Uh-huh.
I was. And then I taught in college. That was the last stint. For 13. Yeah, about 24, 25, connected with the rural schools.
Mm-hmm. So you were still connected to the rural schools during the Second World War.
Yeah, that was kind of the tail end. Mm-hmm. We were dropping, you know, there weren't as many students.
Right, drop fairly rapidly.
Well, and they were going, they were more going into high school teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, there were changes. And, oh, yes, and the student teaching program in Fargo Moorhead was growing.
Mm-hmm.
You see. And rural schools were closing.
When did they start closing?
You see, everything happens so gradually, Dr. Dale.
Yes, as a town grew out, I suppose.
Yeah.
You lose one here and there. And
well, and the enrollments dropped, you know. Mm-hmm. Consolidation went on. Gunderson, which had this beautiful one-room school, WPA project, fireplace in its everything. Everything that was closed, the enrollment dropped, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Smaller families.
Larger farms.
More consolidation, more busing.
Mm-hmm.
Like I say, everything happened so gradually.
So rural schools closed, and the state said you had to have 4 years
right
in order to teach in an elementary school, and mm-hmm. some very big changes took place mm-hmm. then in the 50s
mm-hmm.
and on into the 60s.
Right.
Let's go back to the Second World War. A very different kind of campus, I would guess.
Small.
A lot smaller. And not very many men around.
I wonder how low the enrollment fell.
I think it was down around 225.
Mm-hmm. Few in the dormitories.
Mm-hmm.
When you ask that question, the one thing that comes to my mind, the one event, the campus and World War II. I think I was on the faculty. I don't know if we had a Senate at that time. We had something. Oh, I know. The General Education Committee was meeting in Delcy's office. President Snart was called out. He was gone for half an hour. He came back. He looked pretty sad. He'd had a call from someplace. Would he consider taking a contingent of the Army Air Force
mm-hmm.
on the campus for training barracks? They had to have the answer by next morning.
Mm-hmm.
So he came back. Well, of course, general education looked terribly unimportant to us then. And we discussed it. Oh, it was a sinking feeling, really.
Why?
That's a good question. You don't know what. I think we were left asking, what will happen? And I remember he said, I don't know what will happen, but it's war. And he said, you know, our enrollment is whatever. It was very low. And he said, as a college, we have problems. Well, the answer was yes. And I honestly think it was let's say it was a week before this first contingent marched through the gates and onto the campus.
Where'd they come from?
I don't remember where that contingent came from.
I heard they came from Concordia. I was wondering if that was true.
That might be. But anyway, in the meantime, we had to do some things to get ready. We had to vacate the dormitories. I remember going from house to house looking for rooms for students. But when you have to.
Yeah.
And I remember we had a beautiful set of offices, Education Department, third floor, McLean Hall, the East End. Dr. Christensen had this spacious office, the head of the Department of Education. And that was assigned to the captain. Mm-hmm. Well, up to that time, now get this, up to that time, there had been no smoking on campus, inside the gates, legally. Dr. Christensen loved to smoke a pipe. So wherever it was, he was pushed into another office somewhere along the way. I don't know where it was. And about the next day, I went in to see him, and he was smoking his pipe. I said, "Christy, you're smoking on campus." He said, "I guess if the captain can sit with his feet on the desk and smoke his pipe, I can do the same thing." So really, Dr. Dill, that was the beginning of smoking on the campus. Legally. A little thing. I seem to remember little things.
That lasted about 30 years. Now it's practically illegal to smoke on the campus, or in many parts of it now.
Is it?
Yes.
Because of a hazard?
Mm-hmm. So the change wasn't permanent after all. How did you adjust to the soldiers? You had to set up a special program for them?
Yes. Some of our faculty taught classes with them. I didn't. Dr. Dill, you adjust so fast, you don't know you've adjusted. Mm-hmm. The first thing you knew, in the wintertime, you know, these soldiers were having their drills up and down the halls of McLean Hall. And you just accepted it, thought nothing of it. You just adjust.
Do you remember how long they stayed?
I don't even remember what year they came. Now that I don't remember.
Well, life went on for the rest of the students, I assume. Mm-hmm. Somewhat altered by the soldiers.
Well, there were some interesting things. The soldiers, of course, their life on the campus was pretty well regimented. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they were just human beings, too. And they saw, out of the corners of their eyes, the girls. So it was kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. Many marriages come out of that?
Not that I heard of.
Well, where were you when the war ended? I guess we'll have to talk about the war ending in Europe. School was on May 1945.
Where was I?
Was it an exciting day on the campus?
Oh, yes. I think there was shouting, getting together in groups, talking about how life would be different. Gas rationing was over. We could buy all the coffee we needed. We didn't need to have coupons. We talked about all the restrictions that had been imposed upon us were lifted, just like that. I remember I drove to Minneapolis that first weekend, could buy the gas that I needed. It was, of course, a very happy time.
Right.
Like one of my brothers said, "You know," he said, "I just know I shouldn't do it, but I feel like taking a brick and throwing it through the window, just smashing it, to celebrate."
Yeah.
Which was kind of wild. He didn't do it.
Well, how different life would be. How different was it for the campus then? Obvious ways that GIs came back. Rapidly?
They filtered back.
Mm-hmm.
I was just talking about something the other day. Is Art Nix? He can cut this if he wants. Is Art Nix retiring?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Art's going to retire.
You said, what happened on the campus when the GIs filtered back? I don't know if you said filtered. I guess I used that word. Well, I think Art Nix was in service.
Mm-hmm.
Was he?
Yeah.
Yes, okay. At that time, part of the curriculum
one course in the curriculum, and this was part of general education. We had a course called orientation. Well, it was just that. It was a four-credit course. It was hard to get enough substance, but to orient the student to the college. We did everything from study the catalog to the history of the college to social amenities at teas and at dinners and everything. Well,
that's the part one that hears about most.
Okay. I taught one of those courses, and I had Art Nix. And your question was, these GIs coming back. Well, I knew that Art Nix, as I looked at this, group, I suppose I had 25 in the class, that he was, let's just say that he was a little more mature than the others in the class. And I think there was just the one. There were other men. And I used to wonder, I've talked to Art Nix about it since, what he thought of a course like that. Here he had been in service, and here we were talking about social amenities, going through a receiving line. The faculty had a reception every fall for students. We had a formal receiving line. We wore long dresses, and the men wore dress-up suits. Oh, it was a really beautiful thing, I guess. And we talked that up in orientation, and we practiced going through and what you would say and what you would not say and so forth. And I remember one time saying to Art Nix in class something about, on the side, I bet you enjoy this or something. But he was a real good scout. And we have laughed about it since. And I've thought now, I hope to go to his retirement dinner, and I shall remind him. So I am sure some of those students, some of those men who came back to the campus, they must have found it a little difficult to fit into this kind of quiet. They must have thought some of it was small talk.
Well, how much fitting
did they have? Do you see what I mean?
Yes. But how much fitting did they have to do? Didn't they remodel the college to fit themselves rather quickly?
I'm sure they did. I don't know. I wasn't aware that they did it quickly. Mm. I don't think there was any revolt, Dr. Dill.
No, you already crossed the smoking line, of course, earlier.
We've crossed that.
Mm-hmm.
I was not aware. I was aware, of course, that they were back.
Right.
And we were aware that they had gone through things, really. That we couldn't possibly identify with.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there was a good deal of empathy. But I think they too were very glad to get back into. But I wonder sometimes if they were finding it a little difficult, that maybe we were going at too slow a pace or something.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
They're serious about studying on the whole.
Yes, on the whole. And, of course, they were getting back to family living.
Right.
That was quite a period. We had to do some adjusting, too, I'm sure.
Was there housing for GIs?
Yes. We had some, what do they call them? Veterans barracks.
Yeah.
Yes. Out east of, course, now, everything's so changed when I say east of. Well, east of where Comstock Hall used to stand. It was a row of barracks.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if Art Nix was married at that time.
A lot of marriages in that first half,
mm-hmm.
decade
right.
after the war.
That's interesting. There have been many periods of adjustment, haven't there?
Oh, yes. In the years you've been here, our subject's not properly all the years you were here. We had a few in the last few years, too, didn't we?
Yes. Right.
That'll have to be for another time. About 1948. We're all done.